This is Fresh Air. Ellis Coase has written a new book about something many white people aren't aware of, the anger and pain of the black middle class. He says that despite its evident prosperity, the black middle class is in excruciating pain. Coase's new book is called The Rage of a Privileged Class. He's a contributing editor and essayist at Newsweek and former editorial page editor of the New York Daily News. Coase says many African-American professionals feel betrayed by a broken covenant.
The agreement that these people thought they had with their corporations and with their country, that if they went to the right schools, they worked hard, they did the best of their ability to achieve, they would be allowed to achieve, at least to the extent of their expertise, their abilities, and their effort. And what a number of middle-class black Americans have discovered is that this seems to apply to them less than it applies to many of their white colleagues.
Do a lot of black middle-class people feel that their progress is being cut off?
They feel that it's being constricted by race, and I think it's important to understand that a lot of people feel that their opportunities are being limited irrespective of race, particularly now when we're dealing in the time of corporate restructuring mm-hmm. and downsizing. But in addition to that, there's a sense among a number of black professionals that they are being funneled in certain directions, that they are being denied even the opportunity to aspire to certain positions, that there is a glass ceiling of a sort. One of the things that's most interesting, I think, and that's also rather depressing about the careers of a lot of those who have even gone fairly far in corporate America is that most of them have tended to be limited to a few tracks, to what are considered black jobs, in the words of researcher Sharon Collins at the University of Illinois, who's done some research looking at a number of high-ranking professionals at Fortune 500 companies. And what she found was that well over half of them, I think something approaching 60 to 70% of these people, had risen through affirmative action type positions or risen through community affairs, public relations, community relations, positions which had nice titles, and in some cases vice presidencies, but had very little influence over the corporation and very little impact on the corporate bottom line, and from which it was very difficult to move anywhere else, and also positions that were peculiarly and particularly vulnerable in times of downsizing and in times of cutbacks. So what a lot of these black middle class people are saying, and these black professionals are saying, is that in addition to the whole set of frustrations that increasingly come with just being middle class in this country, there's another whole layer of frustrations which seem to come with being black in this country.
You write about identity troubles that face people in the black middle class at work. What kinds of troubles?
One of the interviews that I did was fascinating. It was with a black executive, who was the senior vice president, human resources for a large corporation. And during the interview, he turns to me and he says, "Ellis, I discovered that in order to succeed, I needed to stop being black." And I looked at the guy, who was quite dark complected and didn't quite know what he was talking about. And he finally explained it. He said, "Well, what that means is that there were certain causes related to, say, civil rights and things of that nature, which I at one point used to either support or express sympathy for, which I just don't express any sympathy for anymore because I don't want to be thought of as basically as a black person. There are other people in the corporation who are black who he had decided he needed to keep his distance from, because otherwise it would be thought that he was somehow coalescing with them and in opposition to the organization for which he worked. He just went through a lot of steps to, in effect, try to convince the people around him that whatever their stereotype was of a black person, he did not fit that. So that was his own specific way of coping, and that, of course, took a lot of psychological energy. The point that Teron Brown, one of the psychologists that I talked with, made was that black executives are just not permitted to even be angry. They are not permitted to be the kinds of bosses that a lot of white bosses are, who shout orders all the time and who are very demanding and domineering. If a black person has that style, that person does not succeed, because all kinds of other messages are communicated that have racial components to them, mm-hmm. that make it very difficult for that person to be a success. All of a sudden, you have the image of the violent, angry black man, and that is not an image that will get you very far in corporate America.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ellis Coase, author of the new book, The Rage of a Privileged Class, Why Are Middle Class Blacks Angry and Why Should America Care? Ellis Coase is also a columnist and a contributing editor at Newsweek magazine. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ellis Coase, author of the new book, The Rage of a Privileged Class. You were interviewed by the late Robert Maxwell for an editorial job, editor of the editorial page at the New York Daily News. And you say that when he was interviewing you, he said, well, what statement would the news be making by hiring you for a top position here?
Right. At the time, I was being recruited, as you note, to be editorial page editor and editorial board chairman of the New York Daily News. And we had a very pleasant conversation for about 10 or 15 minutes, talking about the newspaper and the news business and things that one executive would talk to a potential new executive about. But then he turned around and he looked at me and in very baronial tones said, well, what statement would we be making if we appointed you to be editor of the editorial pages here? What would we be saying to New York? And I knew what he wanted me to say. He wanted me to say something about a racial statement. And of course, I was not being hired for a racial job, so I had no inclination to do that. And I said, well, you would be saying that you were hiring a top-notch journalist to run your editorial operation. He said, yes, 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 but what would we really be saying to New York if we hired you? I said, well, you'd be saying you wanted to improve the quality of your editorial pages. Well, yes, 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 but what would we be saying to all of New York if we hired you? And I said, well, you'd be saying you want a better newspaper, number one. He said, yes, yes, yes. He became very impatient. He said, well, would you be the highest ranking black newspaper man in New York? And I said to him, well, maybe yes, maybe no. It all depends on what you think of titles, what, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I basically refused to play along. And he ultimately dropped the line of questioning. But what became very clear to me in that interview was that I was being treated in a way, and not necessarily disadvantageously, but I was being treated in a way that a white executive would never have been treated. And he was saying to me, if not in so many words, we want a racial symbol up here. Mm-hmm. And we think that you might be a very nice and appropriate racial symbol. And on one hand, that could be nice, I suppose, because I got the job, so it certainly didn't disqualify me from the job. But I think in the longer term, that kind of thinking can be very limiting, because if one is in fact hired to be a racial symbol, and then one is not necessarily hired to be an executive.
Right, right. Do you think he was saying in a way, and if we hire you for this position, aren't we doing something special for your people?
Oh, sure. Sure, he wanted a response, I'm sure, that, oh yes, you would be saying that you're really going to be progressive on racial issues and that you're really a right thinking sort of individual and that you are making a huge statement that the New York Daily News now stands for racial progress or some such nonsense. And as I indicated, I just didn't want to play.
Right. Yeah. It seems to me this must be a hard subject to write about, because a lot of people assume, heck, the middle class, they have a good. What are they complaining about? They're middle class. They've got good jobs. The real problem in the African-American community are the people who are poor and who can't get out of poverty.
Sure. And I'm glad that you raised that point, Terry, because, in fact, that was exactly the reaction of Daniel Patrick Moynihan when I was talking with him about the book. He said, well, you know, the real problem is the problem of the underclass. And I don't disagree with that. I agree that there are some terribly, terribly pressing problems of simple survival in some cases, that affect people who are poor, that affect people who are poor of any color, and that certainly affect people who are poor and who are also black and who are in crumbling inner city communities. No question about that. But by the same token, I don't think that simply because one set of people have problems, that means you ignore all the other problems in society, especially problems that are, in some respects, as racial problems are, linked. And I think that, moreover, we have in this country been sort of trapped in this kind of racial dialogue where we automatically assume that black equals poor, equals ghetto, equals uneducated, equals a number of things which don't necessarily apply because everyone doesn't fit that stereotype.
Some people, and you talk about this in the book, some people think that the problems of the urban black poor are so complex, so difficult, so out of reach to solve that the real hope for the black underclass is the black middle class. The real
right.
hope is that the black middle class will do something to communicate, to become good role models, to do something to help solve the problem. What do you think about that?
I think it's a cop-out, but I think it also illuminates how separated many of us are, how separate many of us are, and talking about racial groups, and how segregated much of our thinking is. Because the fact of the matter is that many of the problems that the underclass, and not only the black underclass, there's also a white underclass, but many of the problems that the underclass face are problems that the black middle class really can't solve, certainly not by itself. You're talking about problems of job creation. You're talking about problems of urban infrastructure. You're talking about problems with the educational system. You're talking about problems of access to decent housing. These are problems that we have to deal with as a society. And I think that what has happened is that a lot of intellectuals, some black but most white, have kind of come to the conclusion that white people can't deal with these things. Let black professionals deal with them. If only the black professionals would go and get people in the ghetto to get good educations and to not commit crimes and to do all these other things which they believe that the people in the ghettos are doing. I think, as I said, I think that's a cop-out because I think that the resources to accomplish a lot of the things we need to accomplish are resources that we have to harness as a country. And to the extent that Americans of any color wash their hands of these problems is to the extent that we just increase the gravity of these problems.
Jesse Jackson just held a conference called Stop the Violence and Save the Children.
Right.
And the conference focused a lot on crime within the black community, focusing on black people as victims of crime and black people as perpetrators of crime.
Mm-hmm.
You had a recent column in Newsweek about Jackson and his new campaign, and you said basically that he might be changing the direction of the civil rights movement.
Oh, I think it's an important issue. And again, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not saying that these are issues that black civil rights groups and that black professional groups shouldn't grapple with. I think they, in fact, are. But I think the larger context in which we are operating is that we have, as a country, a problem with violence. It so happens that violence is a particularly pressing problem among blacks. But the crime problem is not just a black problem. Most whites who are killed in this country, upwards of 85% of whites who are killed by other whites in this country. So we as a country have a problem with violence.
Well, what Jackson said, and you quoted this in your column, was that things have changed from the days when the architects of violence and brutality were the enemies. Now homicide or fratricide and AIDS are the killers of black people. When you say that Jackson might be repositioning the civil rights movement, do you think that he's heading in an important direction by starting to focus more on crime?
Yes, I think he is. I think that a lot of people are very fearful these days because of the problem of violent crime, and that what has happened, or what happened in the past, was that civil rights organizations shied away from that issue.
You what?
They shied away from that issue because they thought it would be misused against them. They thought that if they got into the issue of law and order, they would be pulled into this sort of agenda of arrest more and more black men and put people in jail, throw away the keys kinds of thinking, and that this would be done to the exclusion of the other parts of the agenda that they thought were important, parts of the agenda having to do with investment in school systems or in urban areas. And so they were very reluctant to engage this set of issues. And as a result, they were vigorously engaged by the right wing. and by conservatives. And I think now what the civil rights organizations have realized is that they can't really avoid these issues. So they're going to have to come to grips with them in some way. And the thing that they think that they can contribute that the conservatives don't contribute is also a concern about a lot of the social problems that tend to fuel violent crime.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Ellis Coase is the author of The Rage of a Privileged Class. This is Fresh Air.